This evening, I'd like to have us look at a passage out of Acts. And in the morning, they've been doing a series through Acts. And so I had been thinking about a few things, and then having to speak in the morning, kind of some of these ideas connected with the story out of Acts, and I thought it would just be easier to do it twice today rather than try and come up with two teachings. So if you're here this morning, I apologize. And I think it's like 25 minutes where you can just take off, grab a coffee, and come back for communion. Part of what got me thinking about this is Lori and I had an opportunity to have a few days off together. And so last week we went to a different church. And so they were talking a little bit about their fall, and it got me thinking about our own fall. And I'm not sure if it's on your calendar, but I think this is actually the week, correct me if I'm wrong, that the connection started 17 years ago. This would be, the week before the long weekend. Does that sound right, Bill and Jim? Because anyhow, it doesn't matter. I know I know that I got a call to come candidate just around this time, and when I came out, the connection had, I came out one time before it started and came out one time after it started. So anyhow, we're close to a birthday. We should maybe just find that out and put it on the calendar. But anyhow, it's been 17 years that we have been together as a community. And so there's been kind of this ebb and flow of community life. But the values of community have always been strong, and it's a place that our family has really grown to love. And so part of my thinking around this teaching, it flows out of this idea of what would fall look like. So we're going to look at Acts chapter 17. It's on page 1681. And I'm going to read through this encounter, and I'll just kind of interrupt the text just to add a few little notes, just so that we can kind of get a little bit of some of the context in which this is happening. So this is a story of Paul visiting the city of Athens. If you know about Athens, under the Greek rule, it became a flourishing city. And it had a pantheon and lots of temples, lots of idols to different gods. It became the epicenter for literature, philosophy, and science, and so as a result, it drew intellectuals from all around the world. People like Socrates, Plato, Aristotle all lived in Athens and contributed to conversations and to shaping ideas there. Eventually, Athens was conquered, or the Greek Empire ended. Athens was conquered by the Romans, but the Romans loved lots of aspects of the Greek culture, and so under the Roman rule, it continued to serve as a cultural and intellectual center for the world. By the time Paul arrives at Athens, the city had declined in population and in wealth, but yet its intellect and philosophical discussions were still very much alive, and so there was still that holding on to the idea of wanting to debate ideas. And its temples and idols were all rooted in the Greek pantheon of gods. And so as Paul wandered to the city, he could see all these idols and all these temples. And this is where we find the story beginning. So it says, while Paul was waiting for them, and that them is Silas and Timothy, they're on a journey together. As he was waiting for them in Athens, he was deeply troubled by the idols he saw everywhere in the city. He went to the synagogue to reason with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles, and he spoke daily in the public square to all who happened to be there. And this public square was really this public open space, and it was used for assemblies and markets, but really it was the center of Athenian life. This is where all things happen. So this is where Paul is having these conversations. He also had a debate with some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. And so, just a little side note, that Athens was a home to kind of these rival schools of philosophy. The Epicurean thought was that they taught that nothing should be believed except that which could be proved through direct observation and logical deduction. And their whole idea was that pleasure was the chief goal of life. And the greatest form of pleasure was to live a life of tranquility. And so that would be a life free from pain, from disturbing passions, from superstitious fears, from anxiety about death. And the way they approached God is that they didn't deny there was an existence of God, but they saw it in kind of a dualistic way, where there was this element in which gods existed and humans existed, but the gods didn't care about the humans, and so they, as a result, they didn't really care about the gods. And the other school was this Stoicism, and it was centered on living harmoniously with nature. Happiness was achieved through right reasoning, right thinking, and this right thinking had to align up with the universal reason, and that universal reason in the Greek word is logos, which is what we understand when, in a theological way, that word is used for Jesus as the word. In philosophy, it's kind of this big idea of kind of a universal God. And so happiness is achieved through right reasoning with universal reason, which governs everything. And destructive emotions resulted from errors in reasoning. So virtue then is found in good ethics and right reasoning. Vice was the result of rejecting reason. And so that their approach was that clear and unbiased thinking would allow one to understand universal reason. And so their focus was on improving ethical and moral well-being. And they understood in kind of a theological way that God was equivalent to the nature of the physical universe, and that the two were kind of the same thing, so that individual humans, as being part of nature, were also a part of God. And so they would talk about God and thought of God as a world soul. So this is kind of the thinking and the discussions that are shaping the thought in Athens. And so this is what Paul is kind of debating with these people in the marketplace and talking to the Christians and the Jews in the synagogue. So when he told them about Jesus and the resurrection, they said, "What's this babbler trying to say with these strange ideas he's picked up?" Others said, "He seems to be preaching about some foreign gods." And then they took him up to the high council of the city. And this is, you'll sometimes hear Areopagus, or sometimes in Latin it gets translated Mars Hill. But it represented this group of learned society of philosophers of the city. And it was kind of this city council, but it was also referred to the place. West of Athens, there was this rocky hills. And so this is where they would meet. At first was set up as a court of justice to try people for murder. And then later became a place where they would gather these philosophers and these council members to debate. And they spent much of their time trying to figure out all of the new ideas. And so they have Paul come out there and to this place. And it says, "Come and tell us about this new teaching," they said. This is now verse 20. "You are saying some rather strange things, and we want to know what it's all about. It should be explained that all Athenians as well as the foreigners in Athens seem to spend all of their time discussing the latest ideas." This was kind of their... I like Luke's little parentheses, by the way. This is what they like to do all the time. So Paul was standing before the council, so standing at Mars Hill, and he addressed them as follows. "Men of Athens, I notice that you are very religious in every way. For as I was walking along, I saw your many shrines, and one of your altars had this inscription on it, 'To an unknown God.' This God, whom you worship without knowing, is the one I am telling you about. He is the God who made the world and everything in it. Since he is Lord of heaven and earth, he doesn't live in man-made temples. And human hands can't serve his needs, for he has no needs. He himself gives life and breath to everything, and he satisfies every need. From one man, he created all the nations throughout the whole earth. He decided beforehand when they should rise and fall, and he determined their boundaries. His purpose was for the nations to seek after God, and perhaps feel their way towards him and find him, though he is not far away from any one of us. For in him we live and move and exist. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. And since this is true, we shouldn't think of God as an idol designed by craftsmen from gold or silver or stone. God overlooked people's ignorance about these things in earlier times, but now he commands everyone everywhere to repent of their sins and turn to him. For he has set a day for judging the world with justice by the man he has appointed. And he has proved to everyone who this is by raising him from the dead. When they heard Paul speak about the resurrection of the dead, some laughed in contempt. But others said, "We want to hear more about this later." That ended Paul's discussion with them. But some joined him and became believers. Among them were Dionysus, a member of the council, and a woman named Demarius, and others with them. And this story, as I was reflecting on it, there was a few things that kind of jumped out at me. We understand this idea around idols, and that in that culture, they had specific stones or specific inscriptions or images that were attributed to a god, and the god would be assigned a certain task, and so you would go to this god for a particular need and this god for another need. But it was all about trying to take care of oneself or ask the gods to take care of oneself. I think in our culture, it's maybe not that obvious, but we definitely have idols, the things that we hold up, the things that we turn to try and answer our questions or to fulfill our longings, our needs. And so what's interesting to me about this is that Paul is disturbed about the idols, but he doesn't really go to task about tearing down idols or about why do you have all these idols. What he gets seems to want to get the conversation to is why do you follow idols? Why is it that you have this propensity to want to worship? Why do you have a propensity to look towards something, to fulfill something, some inner longing? And if you kind of read through this thing a few times, you begin to see that Paul almost uses a tack that is quite unusual for him. Most of the time he's like so overt and kind of in your face. But here, as he's talking to these people, you'll notice that Paul doesn't quote Jewish scriptures. He doesn't refer to a history that none of them would have known. He didn't argue from fulfillment of prophecy. He doesn't quote from a book or a manuscript that there no one would have accepted as being authoritative. His point of contact with the council is an altar he had seen in the city to an unknown god. And not only that, he uses their own poets as a way to try to help them understand. He quotes that the poets who say, "We are his offspring." And what I think is really interesting about that is it's three different poets from three different times, three different cities. But this idea that we are his offspring is all in relationship to honoring the Greek god Zeus. So this "we are his offspring" is the poet saying we are the offspring of Zeus. So Paul is taking this "we are offspring of Zeus" and saying, hey, your own poets recognize that you are an offspring of the gods. Now, I don't think that Paul is suggesting that God is another name for Zeus, or that God should be thought of in terms of the pantheon of gods. Rather, I think that Paul is suggesting that their conclusions, their understanding, or their propensity to say these things is a result of all people searching for the same things, trying to make sense of the same questions. And that their pursuit was a result of God's activity in their lives, even if they weren't aware of it. Of God being close while they groped and fumbled their way towards truth. And I really like that the words that Luke uses there. That God's purpose would be for the nations to seek after him. And perhaps, and this is such a funny way of saying it, and perhaps feel their way towards him to find him. And I, in my own, I think my own spiritual journey, that really rings true, this idea of kind of fumbling and sometimes feeling like I'm missing it, and other times like groping around in a dark basement to find God. And so this is this whole kind of thing that Paul is suggesting, is that there's this activity in our lives of a God who is closer than we even realize. And that perhaps as we begin to ask questions, as we begin to explore things, we will fumble our way towards him. In anthropology, or in natural anthropology, there's the idea that every human being is different and every human being is the same. But we, I think, understand that humans are more than just physical beings, that there's a spiritual element. And that if we were to switch that and think of it in terms of a spiritual anthropology, it would be that all people are created in God's image and likeness. And in that same way, we are all unique, and yet we are all distinct at the same time. The poet in Ecclesiastes is working at trying to understand meaning, trying to understand what purpose is of life. And he writes in Ecclesiastes 3:11 that God has made everything beautiful for its own time. And he has planted eternity in the human heart. But even so, people cannot see the whole scope of God's work from beginning to end. And yet all of creation, which includes us as humanity, bears the fingerprints of the Creator, that has these ways in which we would trace back and find our way back to who God is. And so if we were to think about this story, this Acts 17, in our own cultural context, we would still be wrestling with the same ideas, the same questions that Paul was trying to address. How do we have a conversation with someone who doesn't have the same foundational convictions and beliefs as we would have? How do we talk to someone about God who says, well, I don't believe in the Bible. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in objective reality. I don't believe in anything that you do. How do we engage in conversations when people don't accept any of the presuppositions that Christianity, the arguments for Christianity are built on? And it seems, as I read through Acts 17, it seems to me the Apostle Paul is suggesting that all the material needed to help bring a person to an overwhelming understanding of God lies in the human heart, lies in that idea that eternity has been placed in the human heart. That what is needed to bring a person face to face with the reality that God is, that God has spoken, that God wants relationship, that we are created by God and need God, is already in the human heart, planted by God. The revealing of this and understanding of who God is most often, I think, found through relationship and conversation. So if we think about how this might spin out, when we engage people around us and talk about their felt needs, we can help people live better lives. And when we build into relationships and develop community with them, we have the opportunity to begin to have these honest exchanges. As we pray for them, as we invest in friendship, perhaps we may inspire them to take the risk of opening up to Jesus. Our culture, our society, often talks about truth being subjective, that there is no universal reality, that there is no unifying creator. And it seems like a knee-jerk reaction often from the church is to point at our answers. But what's crazy is, and you probably have bumped into this with your own conversation, is that as soon as we point to our answer, everybody else has an answer. Taoism, Islam, Buddhism, atheism, humanism, they all have answers. Everyone has an answer. And so then there's these moments in which we begin this set of arguments. But I think that when we move into apologetics, and that apologetics would be proving truth through presupposition and argument, when we move into that kind of exchange, we move into a mind war, an intellectual battle, an information struggle. And often those just shut down relationships, shut down conversations. And just throwing out answers that way does not open up a human soul. I think that what we need to recognize is that while the world keeps producing so many different answers, we all keep asking the same questions. And so in that respect, the portal into the soul of human being is not in the answers, but in the questions. And when we have the courage to live into the questions that people who do not know God have, they perhaps would find us worth the company. No matter what culture, no matter what people group, all around the world, there are common questions that everyone is trying to work out. Sometimes we think of these in terms of a worldview or a lens in which we look at each other. From what place do I come? Why am I here? To what place am I going? Origin, purpose, and destiny. And so in relation to this, there's so many ways in which we try to work these things out. What is the source of primary reality? What is a human being? What is the true nature of meaning and destiny of humankind? On what basis is morality and ethics established? What is right? What is wrong? What is truth? How is truth known and determined? What is death? Is there an afterlife? There's a pastor and author named Erwin McManus, and he talks about these things as soul cravings. And he suggests that soul cravings inside of each, that there are soul cravings inside of each human soul, and we need to find ways to engage conversations about them. And there's, I think, three things that seem really common to me, and probably you may be able to think of more. I feel like often they all have lines back to the three I'm going to suggest. But three things that would be common to all people. And the first is a search for destiny or future, wanting significance, trying to find something to hope in. And I think it revolves around the question, does life get any better? Will tomorrow be better? Does my life make any difference? What is there to hope in? I think often as human beings, when we no longer are convinced that tomorrow can be any better, there's this opportunity to kind of move into despair, to lose hope. And so sometimes we try to balance that by using the scales of significance and success as a way to kind of to bolster ourselves. But when I think about significance, when I think about using that kind of system, I sometimes don't even know what significance is. I think that that's a common thing. What is significance? And we end up striving to become something that we can't even define. We might have a set of goals, but once we accomplish those goals, then we set more goals. It becomes this kind of circular thing. Who has enough stuff? Who gets good enough grades? Whose relationships are good enough? And on it goes. Timothy Miller wrote, "People honestly think that having just a little more of whatever it is they are pursuing will push them over the edge and they will find true and lasting contentment." But I think that just becomes like the carrot in front of us. And that really the only place in which we really can find significance, hope, future is in God. And yet every human being is striving for a better life worth living. The second thing is that everyone is searching for meaning, to understand what truth is, something to put their faith in. I believe that we are created to live in truth. But truth is not just answers, it's questions. Think about if you have kids or when your kids are really little, they begin to ask who, what, why, when, why. Why is this, why is that? It's kind of almost like the divine fingerprints are in those questions, wanting to know, wanting to understand. Religion, in many ways, is humanity's attempt to make sense of life. And I've heard it said that because there are so many religions, it proves that there is really nothing that is true. I think, though, that you can flip that and say that actually, because there's so many religions, it really proves that we all have the intrinsic sense to find meaning in our existence. That actually, all the religions prove that there is something bigger going on. But people want to know if there is anything trustworthy. Is there anything out there that can be trusted? Search for meaning is a search for truth. But often, that searching becomes disillusioning. And Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And so truth, then, in that way, exists because God can be trusted. And so I think that we, as we engage in relationship, and I think about this for my own self, that to reestablish trust is not on an intellectual battlefield, but through the relational context of earning the right to be heard. Earning the right to be heard. Exchanges, building trust. Every human being needs to make sense of their existence. And finally, I think that there's the common search for community, a place to belong, some place to find love. I think we all know that feeling of what it means to be included and how that feels, to be an insider, to belong. We're not meant to live in isolation or to approach our relationships as if they are self-sustaining units. We need each other. We need community. To exist privately on our own as islands, or to just kind of create ways in which we force other people to do that, is to cause people to live in deficit. And so part of engaging this question, part of this exchange in terms of relationship is to live a life that is a way of inclusion, to embrace people as humans, and to not subdivide into categories of us and them. I think Jesus makes lots of statements about how to live, about what to believe, about what's right and what's wrong. But if you track through the Gospels, his way of living, his way of approaching people was always about inviting people into conversation, into community, to always ensure that there was a place at the table for them, a voice for them to be heard. That his way was a way of inclusion, even to the detriment of his own reputation, that he often took hits for hanging out the wrong people. And if you kind of extrapolate that, then really the church and the people, us as people, we should be the first place that is thought of when people are thinking about finding a place to belong. The church should be the first place, because it should be a guarantee that in that place I would find a place to belong. But too often, I think people experience church as a place of judgment and of finger pointing. I think that's a really hard thing, that it takes a long time to help people understand that it can be trusted, that there can be a way to find community within the context of the church. But every human being longs to be loved. Now, the reason I kind of have been thinking about these things is that I realize that my understanding of aging isn't really so much about birthdays as it is about life events. And so and when kind of these bigger life events happen, it begins to raise questions. I begin to reflect and to think backwards and then as a result think forward, and what will the next few years be like. And for me, there's been a couple of significant things that have happened in the last few months. The first is that our daughter, Annalie, graduated from high school, and so that feels like, wow, I'm getting older. Seems like everybody else is getting older, but I'm not. But then all of a sudden you realize, well, wait a second, if she's out of high school, that means I must be whatever. I mean, we've been here 17 years. That seems like a long amount of time, but it's gone by really fast. The second thing is just reading, and understanding that Cal is retired, and that seems like, wow, if Cal is retiring, that must mean that I'm getting older too. But Cal was a very influential person in my life. He was the first pastor that I really worked with for a long time, and he spent a lot of time mentoring me. And I remember lots of times just sitting in the front of the stage and drinking coffee with him and talking about life and talking about what it meant to follow God, what it meant to represent who God was. And the conversations would always inevitably turn back to, how do we take Jesus out of here to our community, to our neighbors? It always was about that we were a community that was interested in what it meant to not just kind of be self-absorbed, but to move outward. And the thing I really liked about Cal is that he found a way, I think, to inspire imagination in people's lives in ways they could do it. Like he would say, or at least he would inspire it for me. He would say, well, what are you good at? Okay, so you, Clayton, like to play softball. Maybe you guys should put a softball team together and get into a league. Great, okay, yeah, we could do that. Man, if sharing the gospel is connected to playing baseball, sign me up. There's a community that needs a coach for a soccer team. Yeah, you should go do that. Here's some money to buy jerseys for them. When Linda came, it was like, you want to start something down on 20th Street? You should do that. That's a really good way to share the gospel. But it was all about taking inventory of your resources, of your what you could put together time-wise and what you were good at, and then being sent out. And I know that, we immediately were just connected to the connection. It really was a sweet community when we first moved here. And over the last years, this has become our home. And my closest friends are all part of who you are. People that I talk about and people that I say, oh, you should meet this person. They're really fun to talk to, or they're really good at this, or interesting. It was always about wanting to invite people here to meet others. I used to look for opportunities to introduce people to the people at Emmanuel. I used to be really intentional in terms of thinking about how I myself could move the gospel outside the walls of this church to kind of make this a place that people would feel comfortable coming. But but the last few years have been bumpy. I think we all would recognize that, that there's these moments in which momentum seemed to stall and it was just hard. And I think that over a period of time, I just kind of got, sidetracked or tired. And there's this thing I do that I thought I kind of only did at home, but in recent months, Carrie's been making fun of me for doing this, so clearly I do it all over the place. And what happens is, I kind of will be talking, and then I stop mid-sentence and kind of stare out someplace and rub my head, which is maybe why I'm bald here. But and then nothing really happens, and nobody is clear. My kids are like, and you want to finish that sentence, or there's some thought you have. And it's often like, it'll be something like, hey, Carrie, we should make sure that those mics are, and it's just like, those mics are. And then I'm like thinking, I wonder if there's coffee back there, or there's this, and, you know, I'm totally like, just kind of, and I feel like at some levels, that's kind of what's happened to me when I think about sharing the gospel, about being intentional with the gospel, that I kind of stalled a bit. And I mentioned that Laura and I had the opportunity to go to a different church, and they were talking about the fall and talking about saying that they, you know, we should invite people to come, and we have these little invitation things, and maybe you should think of three friends that you could bring. And I was like, man, three friends? I haven't even really been thinking about one friend. But then I was kind of thinking, you know what, though, like, fall is here, and it's an exciting opportunity to actually get more intentional. And one thing that has been really encouraging for me is this summer when we did VBS, we had the most volunteers that we've had with the smallest amount of people here at the church that I would say, in 5 or 6 years. And we had so many kids that we had to kind of cap registrations, and we've made some really good connections with people in the community. And it's suggested to me that as a group at Emmanuel, that there still is some level of, yeah, we can join together and do something good. That we can actually band together and be Christ for our neighborhood. And so I am making this fall for myself time to be more intentional about sharing the gospel, about getting back to looking and recognizing the opportunities that are in front of me. And I'm also inviting you to do the same, to kind of be thinking and recognizing what are the places that I could share, what are the things that I'm good at. And I know I've told this story before, but it's a picture that's really been seared in my mind. When our kids were quite small, we lived across, we lived in the same house, so there's people who lived across the street from us who were quite, I'll just say needy, that's probably the best word. And they were always short on things, whether it was food or relational attention or whatever it was. So they often, their kids would come to our house or we'd go over there and help them with different things. And I can't remember I don't remember exactly what the context was, but I know that they needed something. And I remember our kids kind of banded together and really emptied out their piggy banks and kind of came to this handful maybe say 67 cents and a couple Rutgers toys and a Barbie hair clip or something like that. And they're like, let's buy them a new house with this. You know, we can buy them a new house. And I think that was just a real picture of what Jesus must have seen and the disciples must have seen when this little boy said, hey, I got this bag of fish and bread and maybe you could use it to feed all these people. It's almost laughable, ridiculous. But I think the point is that Jesus says, look, I don't really care how you do it. Fumble your way through it. But just, would you show up with your bag? Just why don't you share your lunch? And I think that this fall we could all share a little bit of our lunch with the people in our city and our community. I think that there's a vibrancy. This community is so sweet. Like I'm biased, clearly, but you'd be hard pressed to find a group of people nicer than all of you, in depth of love for Christ, in depth of commitment for one another, in depth of just goodness. And this would be a place that people would thrive and grow in. But we need to let them know about who we are. We need to let them know about who Jesus is. And every week we come to the table, and sometimes I know it can become a routine because we say it every week. But the point is that we come to the table and we break off the bread and we dip it in the juice. And we understand that we're taking in who Christ is. It reminds us of what Christ did for us, of his love for us. But it's a principle in which we're supposed to then reciprocate that we take in what we take in, we are to become. And in moving out, we are to be his hands and his feet. And so tonight, as you taste the bread, as you taste the juice, as you ask God just to kind of give you a little spark and see if maybe there's some place that you can share your lunch this week, that you can see being intentional about talking to someone or about engaging in some place in your neighborhood or in the city for the sake of the gospel. Let's pray.